Hello, friends. This is the second hour of Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting live from the studios of KKNW on 1150 AM here in beautiful Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle in the United States. The purpose of this program is to raise consciousness and make this world a much better and happier place. And I know that with everyone's help, we can and will make this earth a much better place. During the first hour, I interviewed my good friends Simon Parks and Wynn Keach from England. And during the second hour, I have a wonderful show already. I'll be interviewing Mary Hansen of the group From Hope to Hiroshima, who will be doing a peace ceremony and prayers at Green Lake here in Seattle starting at 6 p.m. on Sunday, August 6th. For more information, please see their website at fromhiroshimatohope.org. After that, I'll be interviewing a wonderful gentleman named Andy Bashago, who said he time traveled in a secret program that took him to Mars when he was a small kid. And he'll be talking about that and also the different species which live on Mars. But before we go to my guests, I'd like to thank everyone so much for their support for this radio program. Out of This World Radio is a nonprofit program supported entirely by donations. And for those who'd like to donate, please go to the donate button at the upper right-hand corner of the program webpage at outofthisworld1150.com and just click on it. I really appreciate your help and support because I know together we can create a much better and happier world. Also, I'd like to tell everyone about an event I'm planning to support the Emoto Peace Project and also Dr. Harvey Biggleson at the Crystal Voyage in Tacoma. It'll be happening on Sunday, September 3rd from 5:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. And Michiko Hayashi will be coming in from Tokyo. She'll be demonstrating what's called the Hado machines. Now, the Hado machines are fantastic machines. They adjust your vibration to correct any kind of physical or spiritual problem, including depression. And they're very effective. They also help with diagnostic abilities as well. The Biggleson brothers, the sons of Dr. Harvey Biggleson, is a famous physician. He uses many of the same techniques for diagnostic purposes in blood work. And he looks at blood. His sons look at blood through the electron microscope, and they can tell what's going on with you spiritually or physically from a diagnostic standpoint. And their systems are very, very helpful. So I hope you can come to that. That'll be free at the Crystal Voyage Bookstore in Tacoma on September 3rd, Sunday, from 5:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m., and I hope you can come. On August 6th, 1945, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. That was followed by a second bomb on Nagasaki on August 9th, 1945. Although the Japanese government had made several attempts before that to end the war with peace feelers too, President Truman, he refused and still dropped these bombs. I think that was the wrong decision. But the purpose of today's program with these prayers, I'd like to bring on Mary Hansen, is to say prayers and the healing for both Hiroshima and Nagasaki so this is never repeated again in the world. These bombs are too dangerous and too destructive to be used again in any kind of situation. But before we start, I'd like to play this famous excerpt just for a minute from J. Robert Oppenheimer. He was a contemporary of Professor Albert Einstein. He helped create the atomic bomb. And as with Professor Einstein, Professor Oppenheimer later came to regret his participation in this terrible bomb of destruction. And this is what he had to say when he witnessed the first atomic bomb go off in July 1945 in the New Mexico desert. Eric, if you could please play this clip, please.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
In the dead silence of the morning at 5:29:45 Mountain War Time, the Jornada del Muerto was bathed in an intense flash of a light that man had only seen from the stars.
We knew the world would not be the same. Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that should do his duty. And to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
J. Robert Oppenheimer came to regret his participation in the development of the atomic bomb, and he became a chain smoker and then finally passed away in 1967. Let's go on to a more positive note. I'd like to bring Mary Hansen now in from this wonderful group called From Hope to Hiroshima, who since 1984, on August 6th, they do a wonderful prayer ceremony and lantern ceremony on Green Lake to bring peace to Hiroshima and also to make people aware that this kind of bomb should never be used again. Mary, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your group and what you'll be going on here in Seattle so people can come and participate.
Well, this group is made up of, the planning of it is done by representatives of many peace groups in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Groups that have been working against nuclear weapons since 1984. The death of the peace movement is not true. There has always been a peace movement. It hasn't gotten very much press attention. But the reality of it is that our event, From Hiroshima to Hope, Lantern Floating Ceremony, is the largest lantern floating ceremony outside of Hiroshima itself.
Beautiful.
And I'll just read our mission statement. The mission of From Hiroshima to Hope is to commemorate the victims of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all victims of war and violence. We educate for peace, nonviolent conflict resolution, and nuclear disarmament through a public outdoor event on August 6th each year featuring music speakers and a lantern floating ceremony. And most importantly, it is an opportunity for people to meditate, to stand on the banks of Green Lake in Seattle, mm-hmm. and watching these lanterns, to meditate and to take strength from the spirits of the people who died and suffered in war, especially the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and their wishes for peace. Their wishes that we turn away from militarism and violence. Mm-hmm. Their wishes that we never use nuclear weapons again. And we have historically had up to 1,000 people. We have up to 1,000 lanterns.
Beautiful.
I think that actually last year, because many families have one lantern for their family, the group mm-hmm. itself was about 1,500 people.
Beautiful.
And The event itself takes place near the Bath House Theater. It's actually south and west of the Bath House Theater. There's a parking lot that goes to that theater, and it's up over a hill that is between the lake and the parking lot. That's where there's a space for a stage where we have our program.
Beautiful.
And then a space for people to create these lanterns, floating lanterns. And then there's a dock that goes out into the lake where we have a procession from the program down the hill to the dock where people help each other to put the lanterns into the water. And then we all stand and it's an amazing sight. It is just amazing. All these beautiful lanterns, candles with rice paper wrapped around, floating on the water.
Oh, how beautiful. Well, that starts then on Sunday, August 6th at 6 p.m., and the address I have here is 7312 West Green Lake Drive North.
Mm-hmm.
And if you need more information, please call area code 206-453-4471. Or you can also email, I'll spell it for you, F as in Frank, H as in Harry, T as in Ted, H as in Harry, volunteers, plural, at gmail.com. And next week, a week from today, Mary, I'll be bringing you on again. For a much larger program on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That'll be at the 2 o'clock hour. But today I just wanted to bring you on for a few minutes to talk about this. I also want to say that there are peace activities going on in Hiroshima as well. And if you'd like to be part of that, you can do it online at www.worldpeace.org. And there's a button there for their teleconference. The timing of that in Japan, it'll be on August 6th from 8:10 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. In the United States and Canada, Pacific time, it'll be on August 5th, Saturday, from 4:10 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. And in England, it'll be on August 5th from 11:10 p.m. to August 6th at 1:30 a.m. And Mary, please hold on. I'd like to bring in my good friend Jerry Bedlington. He's a specialist on bringing in angel healing work. And I'd like to ask Jerry to bring some angels in to help to be with you in your ceremony on Sunday, as well as to send some healing to both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Jerry, are you there?
Yes, I am with you there. You bet.
Great. Jerry, if you could ask your angels to come in, and I'd like to give some angelic help to Mary Hansen and her wonderful friends for this wonderful ceremony on Sunday, as well as send some healing love and light to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, please.
Okay, great. Mary, hold your hand out like I'm going to put an apple in it.
Thank you.
Give me all teams in here. Hi, guys. Guys, touch Mary's hand and let her know you're present. Touch your hand and let her know you're present. You may feel some tingling, some lightness, maybe a breeze. You feel them?
Mm-hmm.
Good. You can ask for a hug. They'll give you a hug, too, if you like. Guys, in the right-hand hologram of both of these sites that were bombed, give me a visual. Give me a visual. Ted, you got a visual on them?
I do.
Guys, we have, last week we took individual souls that were still locked in the physical plane. We took them home. I want you to scan the place again, guys. Give me a tracker team. Scan again and go dimensional if we have to. Make sure we don't have anybody left there. We need to take them all home to security, wait their presence. Give me a count of 20 on it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. Do we get some more there that were lost?
Yeah. There's been spirits locked in there in kind of a neither zone, totally lost for decades since 1945, since the bombings. And we just brought them into the light just now.
Oh, good. Yeah. Guys, two transition teams for each one of these individual souls. Let's take them home. Creator wastes our presence. If they need to go to the Temple of Light first for rehabilitation, then take them there first. Thanks, guys. Give me a count of 15 on that, taking them home. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Are they looking? They all head home now?
Yeah, they are. And we'll be doing more of this a week from today. And I'd love to have you back then as well, Mary.
Okay, you bet.
Yeah. Well, Mary, I hope you have a beautiful and beautiful event on Sunday. I plan to go, and I'm so looking forward to meeting you and your friends. And thank you again so much for doing this. I want to tell you too. There's also a peace event going on in the San Francisco Bay Area. I had asked the organizers of that event to be on as well on the show today for a few minutes, but they said they couldn't. But I wanted to tell everybody about it. It will be happening in San Francisco, and I'm sure there will be other prayers as well. But the Seattle one is very big. And if you are in the area, please come. It'll be on Sunday, August 6th, starting at 6 p.m. It's a beautiful ceremony, and your prayer and love will help make this world a better place.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mary. Arigato. And Jerry, thank you so much for bringing the angels in. Appreciate it.
Okay. Bye, Ted.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. We'll be on the air next week. We'll be doing some more angel healing work for Hiroshima and Nagasaki from the 2 to 3 p.m. hour on August 11th. And now, for something completely different, I'd like to bring in my good friend, Andy Bisciaggio. He's a Washington State lawyer who says he's traveled to Mars, where he had an amazing experience. Andy, are you there?
Yes, Ted. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's so good to have you on today. We just did a little prayer ceremony for Hiroshima. They're having a big ceremony up here in Seattle on Sunday, August 6th. It's starting at 6 p.m. They have it every year since 1984, and I think the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were a terrible mistake. But anyway, for healing, I wanted to do that program. But you have an amazing background, don't you, Andy? I mean, you said you before that I've met Andy. He's got an amazing story where he traveled to Mars, where he met Gary Sotelo, a.k.a. Barack Obama, before he became president through a secret U.S. government time travel program. I remember seeing you give a presentation at the Triad Theater in Yelm here, I think it was last month, and you said there is various kinds of living entities on Mars. It's inhabited, including hybrid Sasquatch humans, Sasquatch grays, reptilians, insect-like creatures. And there's also, and I'd love to ask you more about this too, about an ancient Mars human civilization. You also said, I remember reading on the internet that you time traveled back to 1863 to hear President Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg speech.
Well, yeah, let me go back a tick. Actually,
okay.
I was a critical participant in DARPA's Project Pegasus.
Okay.
Between 1968 and 72, when I was a child.
Okay.
We were standardizing essentially eight different forms of time travel. So in that capacity, I was the first American child to Tesla teleport.
Wow.
When I jumped through a Tesla device in the winter of 1968 as a six-year-old.
Wow.
At the Curtiss Wright Aeronautical Company facility in Woodridge, New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
And popped out a few seconds later in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Wow.
Whereupon my father took me up into a meeting with Dr. Harold M. Agnew when he was the director of the weapons division at the Los Alamos National Laboratories, who would go on to be the director of Project Pegasus.
Mm-hmm.
When he became the director of LANL in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a background on a defense technical project under DARPA, basically the defense technical project, mm-hmm. in which time travel was achieved in the fall of 1970 when they found a way to adjust the Tesla teleporter so that the teleportee arrived in the location that they wanted, but in what we would call the past or future mm-hmm. at that location.
Mm-hmm.
What I was describing at Yelm recently, where you were present, was as an attendee, were some activities that I was involved in during my college years at UCLA a decade later, in the first half of the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't meet Obama on Mars. I was trained with him.
Mm-hmm.
I roomed with him for a period of time, a couple of days before I got my own room during our training.
Sure.
And I was present with him in Los Angeles at the jump room facility in El Segundo, California, and several times on the surface. So I and a handful of other whistleblowers have come forward and given our Mars testimony. And there was an interesting historical footnote, and that is that one of our fellow jumpers ended up becoming the 44th president of the United States, Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
We had a dilemma as to whether we should reveal that because we were concerned that if we did, people would use it to discredit our testimony. But then on the other hand, mm-hmm. if we held back the fact that a future president was, the current sitting president at the time of our disclosures was a participant, then we were concerned, the countervailing concern was that we would be accused of concealing that for the CIA or for mm-hmm. Obama,
mm-hmm.
For the U.S. government in general. So we decided mm-hmm. to go forward, and we reached the conclusion that if the truth movement's going to mean anything, it has to mean the truth.
Right.
So we told the truth, which is that Barack Obama is a former American astronaut. He mm-hmm. was in the CIA's Mars Jump Room program. And I and several other whistleblowers who've come forward independent of me have testified to that fact
mm-hmm.
publicly.
Wow. Well, you know what? I believe you. And I just, I'm a psychic. I look on the other side all the time, and my spirit friends tell me whether something's true or not. And what you're saying resonates with me. And I believe you, what you're saying. What has been, just curious, what has been his response to it? Has he ridiculed you?
Well, actually, when I came forward with my fellow jumper, William B. Stillings, and Laura M. Eisenhower, the great-granddaughter of President Eisenhower,
who
was approached to settle on the Red Planet in the 2006-2007 time frame, which was 25 years after I first went to Mars as one of the jumpers.
Sure.
We were on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on November 10th of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the Obama administration did something very interesting. A month and a half later, the president used the spokesperson for the National Security Council, Tommy Vitor, to plant an article in Wired.com, that's Wired Magazine Online, one of the principal journals of the digital age.
Right.
And to basically plant an article that was consistent with the policy from the CIA's Robertson panel of 1953, of essentially addressing the extraterrestrial topic by utilizing public smear campaigns involving fear and ridicule. What he basically did is kind of guffawed at our assertion that he had been on Mars. But if you think about it, when was the last time, or even the first time for that matter, when a sitting United States president, confronted by what readily could have been dismissed as an urban legend or conspiracy theory, made it his business and actually discussed, actually vetted with the National Security Council, which is the implication of his spokesperson's involvement in planting the article, something that could have readily been dismissed, you know, as an urban legend or conspiracy theory. We regard Obama's guffawing, sort of disinformational article in Wired.com as what the law calls a tacit admission, in the sense that if it, what we were saying wasn't true, he didn't need to comment. But the fact that he did comment belied a concern that the truth would be known. That's our testimony, and it's true testimony.
I have to, you know, every once in a while out of Hollywood, you'll get a movie or coming out that actually has some truth in it about what really goes on behind the scenes. And the most recent one, I want to give you an example, was there's a new movie out, Jason Bourne. This is his second movie. It's kind of like he's portrayed as a rogue CIA agent who finds that he was manipulated, and all this stuff goes on. But one of the scenes in this new movie, Andy, if you get a chance, I recommend that you see it, was that there were several scenes in the movie about how the CIA uses disinformation through public media sources to plant information and stories that are totally false, to lead people off in the wrong direction, to try to discredit people for all the wrong reasons. And it just confirms what you just said. But it's sort of fictional, but it resonates as the way they do.
I'll take a look. I mean, I've been public with my time travel and Mars visitation account since 2004. That's 13 years. And I can tell you that I have had some very thoroughgoing disinformation directed at me. I've been accused of atrocities. I'm a lawyer in good standing, admitted to the United States District Court for the Western District of Washington and to the Washington State Bar Association. I've been practicing for 21 years without a client complaint, much less a disciplinary action. And I've been accused of everything, even by people in the so-called truth movement, presumably government agents in the truth movement, everything from not existing and being sort of a CIA legend to atrocities. And, you know, Ted, I've never even committed a misdemeanor offense. I mean, I have a couple of traffic infractions like most drivers do, but I've never committed a crime. And I've had the big lie directed at me by government operatives, including false claims of committing atrocities. So, yes, the government's playing for keeps in terms of smearing the American people's truth tellers. The very people who served in defense projects were not paid, were not benefited, were injured. And now almost, you know, I first teleported 49 years ago. I was trained for Mars in summer of 1980, 37 years ago, and first went to Mars in July of 1981, 36 years ago when I was 19 years old.
That's amazing.
Today I'm 55, and I'm you know, we're a generation and a half behind in terms of knowing what the government's done with our tax dollars in applied science. And I think I'm serving the interests of the American people.
You are.
That's bringing them up to speed on these two programs.
Yeah, and you're being heard worldwide on my show, too, so you're getting a wide audience. But I have to ask you, Andy, if they were if you traveled back to see President Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in 1863, back when you were a small child, and you traveled to Mars back in the 80s, that was, almost 40, 50 years ago now. What do you think they're doing now? Certainly they must have developed the technology further.
The last thing that I did connected to the defense technical community of our country was in my first year of law school in Portland. I attended Lewis and Clark Law School before
good school.
Earning a Master of Philosophy at the University of Cambridge in England. And I love my education there at Lewis and Clark. It's a great law school. But in my spring of my first year, I was instructed by the CIA to travel to Socorro, New Mexico, because I had had so much exposure to advanced, applications in quantum physics, both in childhood and then during my college years, that they wanted me to take part in this exposure to a large electromagnet to fix my position in time-space. They were concerned I would become quantum destabilized.
Oh, really? That you might walk out your door one day out of your dorm room and go into the 17th century by mistake?
Well, or disappear off a bar stool like the participants in the Philadelphia experiment.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so that was spring of 1989. I entered Lewis and Clark Law School in August of 1988. So that was the spring of my 1L year as a law student. And that's the last thing I did of a technical nature involving the United States government. So that was what? That's 11 plus 17. That's 28 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I have not had any contact with any defense or intelligence agency since then. My truth campaign is a personal mission.
Right.
It's not a government operation. And so I can only, like other Americans, speculate as to what our government's doing. But here's one benchmark I can provide. I think the most relevant thing that was ever said by somebody in the defense technical community was voiced by Ben Rich, the CEO of Lockheed, shortly before his death. He said, anything you could imagine that you think we've accomplished technically, we have. And then he continued and said, we now have the technology to take E.T. home. So when I hear stories like the story that Bill Ryan and Len Kasten have told about Project Serpo,
right,
that a group of American astronauts traveled outside our solar system to another inhabited planet
system. I've heard stories about that. I interviewed a fellow who researched it thoroughly. He said it was the real deal. And
right.
Yeah, so go ahead. Yeah.
I would hang my hat on Ben Rich's statement. You're talking about the CEO of Lockheed Skunk Works. I mean, the Ralph M. Parsons Company of Pasadena, California, Lockheed Skunk Works of Burbank, California, and Hughes Aircraft of El Segundo, California, were the three defense contractors that I was directly dealing with when I was jumping to Mars. In fact, there's an interesting historical footnote to that doesn't involve Obama, but involves who was directing the Mars Jump Room program at that Hughes Aircraft facility in El Segundo. It was Howard Hughes, the legendary aviator and founder of Hughes Aircraft.
Oh, my goodness.
At a time after he was supposed to already have been deceased.
Right.
Howard Hughes lived on, and certainly through the early half of the 1980s, and I had personal contact with him.
Wow.
That fact has now been established by two biographers of he named Douglas Wellman and U.S. Army Major General Mark Music, who have written a book called, a biography of Howard Hughes called Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes, where they established that his death was faked in April of 1976 to prevent Howard Hughes from abduction or assassination when he was working on advanced defense technical projects connected to the CIA.
Wow.
Howard Hughes, I can testify, was also a guest at lunch of Project Pegasus around 1970 in New Mexico. I remember this big event where this VIP guest was visiting the project when my father and I were serving on it, and it was Howard Hughes.
Wow.
It was explained to me that it was the legendary aviator Howard Hughes.
Wow.
So part of the hidden history of the secret space program is the hidden history around the career of one of our truly legendary aerospace pioneers, and that's Howard Robard Hughes.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
He lived on and was working on these types of projects.
I'm sure the kind of technology they have now would totally blow people's minds in terms of what they can do, including one of the things I wanted to ask you about. I know that that there are negative entities out there, and they're called the reptilians and the greys, and they use they're master geneticists, from what I've been told by my friends in the Galactic Alliance, and they can clone a human being very easily. They've been doing it for decades. Did you ever hear much about that in your experience with the secret programs, Andy?
Not cloning, but let me distinguish your comment about the entities.
Okay.
We know from the work of individuals like Dr. Joseph Farrell and Dr. Michael Sala that the reptilians were aligned with the Nazi regime during World War II.
Dr. Sala is a great researcher, by the way.
Absolutely. In fact, I partnered with him. He's investigating my time travel experiences utilizing the Freedom of Information Act. He's already finding things that establish the historicity of my claims. Yes, he's a fine academic, and it's a privilege to be working with him.
Yeah, good man.
Now, when I was a child in Project Pegasus, we learned that, in fact, it was the small greys who intervened in ancient Sumer to kickstart civilization after our civilization had been going sideways for 6,500 years after the solar system catastrophe around 9500 BC.
Mm-hmm.
I also know from my experiences in Pegasus that the small grays have been abducting humans in earnest for several hundred years. It's known that they've been abducting or contacting particular people, and that such people can expect to be contacted throughout their lives.
Yeah.
Now, the specific ET group that was helping the Allied war effort during World War II were the Nordics, as it's been established in a replete way by a former Douglas aircraft official by the name of William Tompkins, who Dr. Stahl has also done an excellent book.
I talked to William Tompkins earlier this year. Yeah, good man. I liked Bill Tompkins.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Now, although they've been contacting particular people,
yeah,
the information that we have is actually that the small grays have had a benevolent impact on the human race.
Hmm.
Certainly, one thing that the contactees have in common, according to a conversation I had with Dr. Roger Lear, is a higher creativity. So it looks like the small grays, or at least one of the small gray factions, has been trying to upgrade our civilization by influencing the creative development of particular individuals.
Hmm.
One thing else I could share about this whole question of who we're being visited by,
right,
that both I, when I was a child on Project Pegasus in the late 60s, early 70s, and 10 years later in the early 1980s when he was the defense minister of Canada, that individual being
Paul Hellyer,
the Honorable Paul T. Hellyer.
Yeah,
were both briefed on. Yeah, another person.
He just wrote a foreword to my book. It's going to be published next week.
So. Oh yeah, he's a great man and a fine public servant,
a fine human being. Yeah, great
guy. He's just a wonderful person. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Paul has confirmed my testimony.
Oh great,
that we were briefed on the fact that the four types of ETs out of approximately 70 that have been visiting our planet that are known, that the four that are visiting us frequently are the tall grays, the small grays, the reptilians, and the Nordic.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like the grays have played kind of a custodial role, but there was some partisan activity by the reptilians advancing the interests of totalitarian regimes like the Nazi German regime.
Right, right.
And the Nordic siding on the side of the democratic and humanitarian regimes like our own.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a muddled history right now, but I would definitely, based on the information I know, I would definitely not stigmatize at least the small grays.
Well,
because it looks like they have intervened in a beneficent way at different periods in our history.
I think, it's not a monolithic group. I mean, I think there's probably factions within them, some of which are terrible and look at humans like we look at chicken to eat or cows.
Right.
And
right.
I think the universe outside of this planet, Andy, is kind of a mixed bag. It's like in a forest. Some are good animals. Some animals are benevolent. Some not. And I think it's. But you kind of have to think that there's both good and bad out there in the universe, and I quite agree, Ted.
In fact, yeah. I'm urging an ET contact policy that will extrapolate from what we know about creatures on this planet, which mm-hmm. there are basically benevolent creatures like dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
There's neutral creatures like, I don't know, sturgeon, and then there's potentially malevolent creatures like sharks.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at fish in the ocean, or ocean-dwelling creatures. Now, if we extrapolate to outer space, it's intelligent for us to develop an ET contact policy that's subtle and nuanced and at least anticipates that same breakdown across the spectrum from benevolent to malevolent. And so we shouldn't generalize. We can certainly also say in regard to the grays that there are many gray species or typologies. So to talk about the grays monolithically is to generalize in a way that's not particularly intelligent. We're really dealing with different groups, and so we should reckon accordingly.
I'm sure you know Alex Collier, the Andromeda contactee.
Right.
He said I was fortunate to meet him at Rob Potter's conference in August of 2015 at Mount Shasta. But he said that that the face on Mars that Richard Hoagland talks about is actually an Orion king or leader that was put there. Eons ago, before there was a part of the grays which were captured by the reptilians. and they were forced into being, they were genetically modified into being a kind of a slave species. Not all the grays happened to them, but there was a faction that happened to it. But they're, you know, so you've got all these different groups here competing. And we ourselves, my galactic friends tell me that the human body here on this planet, Andy, is the product of interaction with 22 different civilizations. And they actually, many species outside of this planet call humans here genetic royalty because we've got such a genetic mix. And one more thing, too, I want to tell you quick, is that, and love your reaction to it, that a lot of our DNA has been intentionally shut down. And it's not junk. Our scientists call it junk, but it's actually they're there for a purpose. And if we unlock those purposes, we could really, really advance quickly.
Well, we know there's at least 26 genes that have been identified as extraterrestrial genes.
Mm-hmm.
I can also say that Alex Collier's testimony about some of the Martian ruins being Orion in origin, that links up because Hoagland, Barra, and Munk mm-hmm. found that the Cydonia complex mirrors Orion on the one hand, mm-hmm. and that star pattern is also mirrored in the Great Pyramid complex at Giza, Egypt.
Okay, that makes sense.
And my
sure.
my rover, rather than satellite-based anomaly research society, the Mars Anomaly Research Society, which your uh-huh. listeners can find on Facebook,
okay,
a Facebook group,
uh-huh.
we have found the Rosetta Stone of the High Egyptian presence on Mars.
Really?
In the form of it's either something that was printed or carved mm-hmm. in the manner of an intaglio mm-hmm. of a pharaoh, the face of a pharaoh.
Wow.
Complete with the conical headdress and wajet, which was the cobra ready to strike motif that was the symbol of Lower Egypt that became the symbol of all of Egypt during the reign of the pharaohs.
Uh-huh.
So we have found, among other evidence of Egyptian ruins on Mars, literally the face of a pharaoh, either carved or stamped into what is either a piece of metal or rock.
Wow.
It was photographed by the rover Spirit on the 2012 sole of its journey on Mars, which is a remarkable coincidence.
Wow.
You know, 2012.
Wow.
On its 2012th day on sole, Martian day,
mm-hmm.
The rover Spirit photographed this mm-hmm. face of a pharaoh, and it's very distinctive. It's somebody with African and European heritage. It looks not unlike President Obama as such an individual. And it's carved into the rectangular piece of rock or metal in the corner so that the corner of the material that it's carved into or stamped into looks like or relates to the face in the same way that the pyramid can be found behind the face of the Sphinx. When you examine the Sphinx in front of the Great Pyramid.
Wow.
So it's clearly from that civilization at that time. And so I'm just happy to tell your listeners that the fingerprint, the Rosetta Stone of the High Egyptian presence on Mars, has already been discovered.
Wow.
And it was discovered by my organization, the Mars Anomaly Research Society.
That's amazing. Now, the thing that you mentioned before briefly, it was... It was when I saw you in Yelm, you mentioned there were different species of creatures there on Mars, hybrid Sasquatch
Indeed.
Humans, Sasquatch grays, reptilians, insect-like creatures. And I'm sure my listeners would love to hear more about that from what you know of
right.
or saw there, if you could explain just a little bit.
Well, there's really two issues. One is that there's hybridization on Mars. Three types of hybrids that I can, before I go into the typologies of primates,
mm-hmm.
let me just say that hybridization is a significant biological issue in the mm-hmm. exobiology of Mars, and we really don't know why. I can speculate, but I encountered a half-man, half-grub-like creature on Mars on my second jump. And when I went up with Courtney M. Hunt of the CIA,
mm-hmm.
we encountered a hedge or vine of lotus-like blossoms that had been hybridized with human faces.
A blossom?
If you could imagine... a flower bed with rather than conventional centers to the flowers or the blossoms,
yeah.
objects that looked like human faces inside the blossoms.
Oh, my God. Wow.
As if primate and flowering plant genes had been mixed.
Oh, my God.
And also in my anomaly work, going back to the publication of my landmark paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, in 2008, I show a creature that we call the Scorpion Man because it features, again, the bald head and muscular shoulders
right.
of a Caucasian male human with the lower extremities, literally, of a scorpion. So one of the major issues that we can say about the life forms on Mars is that something caused hybridization, whether it was a nuclear war in the past, as speculated by Dr. John Brandenburg, or whether in antiquity or in modern times Mars has been used to quarantine genetic experiments, or there's just been a pattern of hybridization there of species that we would recognize on Earth.
Wow.
There are different hybrids. Now, in terms of primates, and by the way, there's also just conventional animals that are singular and logical in their form and are not apparently hybrids of known or unknown or living or extinct Earth species.
Yeah.
But there's also five distinctive primate species, and I think that's what you're referring to that I covered in my recent talk
right.
at the Triad Theater in Yelm, Washington, which is the first type are the descendants of Earthlings who went to Mars during the previous civilization on Earth, the one that was eclipsed by that solar system catastrophe around 11,500 years ago.
Okay. Oh, you mean when Marduk blew up? Is that?
Yeah, when space debris came into our solar system and severely damaged Mars and Earth and led to massive flooding on both planets that we now record in the biblical flood and the flood recounted in the Epic of Gilgamesh. You know, Richard Hoagland has said something fairly intelligent, which is that Mars is one big muddy wasteland. Well, it became a desert planet and a big muddy wasteland as a result of huge flooding caused by that strike from objects coming in from space. We don't know exactly what they were. So that cut Mars off from Earth when the planet that is variously called what, Marduk, Maldek, or Tiamat disintegrated. Mm-hmm. And in the reckoning of Sir Isaac Newton, who mathematically established that a planet should be where the asteroid belt is, disintegrated and speculated led to the creation of the asteroid belt.
Wow.
There's really two asteroid belts, both the Kuiper belt and then the larger asteroid belt.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that those Martians could probably procreate with it because they've only been separated from our population for 11,000 to 12,500 years.
Okay.
We call them Homo Martis Terris, or Earthmen and women on Mars. They look virtually indistinguishable from modern humans on Earth, except the men tend to be more muscular and have larger thoracic cavities because they have evolved for that many thousands of years in a planet with far less oxygen than Earth. They have very large lung capacity.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now the second type are the indigenous Martians that were there when we went there in antiquity.
Sure.
They're the ones that are smaller than us. They tend to have narrow, long heads and faces, pointy ears. Some of the adults have antennae that can protrude from the temples, the left and right temple of the forehead.
Wow.
They often have poor teeth, you know, bad dentition, and they have long fingers and a very shy, recondite personality. They are what led to the meme of Martian on Earth because in antiquity, they were coming here. So, you know, our ancestors on Earth knew what a Martian looked like because they were coming here when we were going there. Then there's a type that seems to be a hybrid between a gray ET species and some kind of terrestrial primate like a lemur. We call those Homo Martis extraterrestrialis. They're basically a terrestrial gray ET-like species. There's a more diminutive Sasquatch than we find on Earth, about a 6-foot tall Sasquatch species that we call Homo Martis Sasquatchus, that I never saw on Mars, but I have seen numerous times in the anomaly data that we get from, that we're analyzing from NASA and the European Space Agency. And then there's very, very tiny primates that we call Homo Martis de minimis, that are about a quarter inch tall.
Really?
Yeah, and they're kind of bookish. They tend to look kind of cartoonish, and they are soil-dwelling primates, which does not exist on Earth, and they are tiny. In fact, Dave, one of the Mars anomalists, the early Mars anomalists in the modern era, Dave Beamer, first published images of diminutive Martians that had been crushed under the wheels of our rovers already 11 years ago in 2006.
Oh, wow.
I never saw those on the surface, but there was one incident when I was on the, in one of my 40 or so jumps to Mars, when I heard distant screaming that I now realized were these de minimis primates underfoot. And I had a discussion with Courtney Hunt of the CIA, and he said, yeah, they're one of the primate types. They're these tiny little humanoids that you may very well have been stepping on, because we know that we accidentally sometimes step on them and kill them unintentionally.
Did you ever watch The Twilight Zone when you were younger?
Sure. I was a child of the 1960s, so I grew up with that and the time tunnel and Star Trek and everything.
Okay. There was one episode on Twilight Zone years ago where this planet, humans from this planet, go to a planet that's very dry and desolate, and it had almost like desert, much like Mars. And when they get there, one of the crew members starts to take a walk outside, and he discovers a civilization where all the inhabitants are about a quarter of an inch tall, very tiny, and they have complete civilization. And he finds out they're there because he starts stepping on them. They all start screaming, and he hears the screams. So that's an episode you may want to try to find.
It sounds like it may have been inspired by the actual Mars. Because let me make this observation: I wasn't briefed on it, and I never officially during my training in summer of 1980, and there was nothing that I directly interacted with in my 40 or more jumps between 1981 and 84. But the last 30 or so trips I took up there, I was simply bringing a computer disk, what we used to call a floppy disk. Remember the 3.5-inch?
Oh, I remember them very well.
Rigid floppy disk. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sure.
They would appear in the commercial sector in the early 90s, but in the early 80s, we were using them to ferry intelligence data physically to the red planet, the telecommunications outposts on the surface. And to get to one of those, I would frequently walk through this dilapidated brick city. The bricks were dark brown and looked manufactured sort of like almost the size and color of like ice cream sandwiches. You know, that dark brown you have in an ice cream sandwich.
Sure.
And about that size. And on Earth, the only brickwork I've seen like that is in neighborhoods that are like 200 or more years old, like let's say the historic district of Philadelphia.
Sure, right.
So I think that when individuals like Edgar Rice Burroughs were writing about Mars, since so much of what they wrote was actually accurate in terms of, for example, multi-appendaged Martians with forearms rather than two and so forth, as in fact was depicted during
Teeter? John Cheater, the time traveler?
No, not John Teeter. There was a John something.
Okay, I'll remember it. We'll get off the air and then I'll remember it. But go ahead.
In any case, I don't know whether that dilapidated brick city was of Earthling manufacture, but it certainly could have been. I think that secret societies may have been visiting Mars sometime after the scientific revolution in a way that really hasn't been mapped. And I would also add that a Mars experiencer named Genevieve stated that he went to Mars in a mission that was organized by the Italian physicist Guglielmo Marconi, who you may recall was the original claimant to radio before they then took the patent from Marconi and gave it to Nikola Tesla.
Sure.
Posthumously.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that this dilapidated brick city may have dated from the time of the American Revolution, let's say, but it may have dated from, let's say, the 1920s or 30s. Because Marconi claimed that he first went to Mars in 1958, which is right around the time of the founding of our National Space Agency. So presumably there would have had to have been either a Catholic Church directed or some international or corporate or secret society based Mars program to create such a dilapidated city, because it certainly looked like brickwork that would have been no more recent than, let's say, the time of the Great Depression.
Sure.
So I would just throw that into the mix, that there seemed to be ancient, not ancient, but older architecture there that may have dated from our civilization, but at not so recent a time frame.
Fascinating. Well, if they were jumping using this Tesla technology back in the 80s to Mars, do you think they're jumping to other galaxies and also to other planets in the solar system like Jupiter, Mars, or Jupiter
and
Saturn?
Well, I don't know. And as a principle in the truth movement, you know, the principle that I honor is to only talk about what I know and indicate when I am speculating.
Right.
I would say almost certainly we're leaving the solar system.
Right.
I know that there's evidence of Earthling visits to other celestial bodies in our solar system beyond Mars. For example, Iapetus, a moon of Jupiter, has evidence of mining having gone on.
And also Courtney Brown has remote viewed Iapetus and said there's a big resort there that hasn't been used in a long time. But it used to be a resort.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and also Enceladus, a moon of Saturn, has a huge humanoid face on it, which is either Earthling or extraterrestrial design. The solar system is a stranger place than we were taught in school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And also, too, I've been told many times that it's teeming with life, Andy.
Well, certainly some of the celestial bodies are inhabited. Of course, what distinguishes Earth is a huge, rich, biodiverse ecosystem.
Sure, sure.
That may have once existed on Mars, but it's certainly not there now. Mars is a desert planet with sparse vegetation and only incidental animal and humanoid life forms.
Sure.
I hardly ever encountered humanoids or animals on the surface, but in those 40 jumps, I encountered both humanoids and different kinds of animals, and even, you know, inevitably or very dangerous predator species as well. So it's a hostile desert environment, relatively comfortably warm in the equatorial regions and fairly bitterly cold in the poles.
Right.
But it certainly gave me an appreciation for the biodiversity of this glorious planet that we live on, because
wonderful.
Earth is teeming with life, but Mars is rather scant in terms of its both its animal and vegetative life form.
Sure. It's seen better days. I just want to say we've got about a couple minutes left, and I want to thank everyone so much for listening today. Andy, you've been so interesting. I just want to remind everybody I'll be down at the Crystal Voyage Books Spiritual Center tomorrow on Saturday and Sunday. If you'd like to come down, it's a wonderful place. It's located at 302 South Cedar Street, right next to the Tacoma Mall. And Andy, tell me, are you planning any public appearances soon where people can come and meet you?
I will be appearing back at the Triad Theater in Yelm in the second half of August. We haven't planned the date yet.
Okay.
We're having basically a fun night where three Washington State lawyers are discussing at length and depth their pet conspiracy theories. I'm going to be addressing my elaborations of the original Lincoln-Kennedy assassination conspiracy literature.
Okay. Great.
Where I found about 40 more coincidences.
Mm-hmm.
Tina Foster, which is the stage name of a Washington lawyer by another name, is going to be discussing her research into the notion that the original Paul McCartney was killed in an automobile accident on September 11th of 1966 and replaced by musician William Shepard, who's the current Paul McCartney.
Okay.
And attorney Stephen Pidgeon, that being his real name, is going to be discussing the actual nationality and parentage of President Barack Obama, arguing that, in fact, the cover-up was of the fact that Barack Obama is the illegitimate son of Malcolm X. Of Malcolm X, that's what they were concealing with the birther controversy.
Interesting.
Nationally, I'll be speaking at the New World Consciousness Expo in Orlando, Florida, on August 11th and 12th.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I have listeners in Orlando, Florida, I know that they'd love to see you. Andy, thanks so much for coming on today. I really enjoyed your interview. You're so interesting. And I hope everyone has a fantastic and wonderful weekend. And next week we'll be having another program on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I hope you all have a beautiful and happy weekend. Thanks so much for listening today, everyone. Bye-bye.